From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from advocates who want more people to know about the risks of lead poisoning in harvested deer.
Lead is a potent neurotoxin. It's toxic to children and adults, but young children are the most vulnerable to it.
Then our Books and Beyond series explores the impact of Milwaukee Public Library's Entrepreneur in Residence. Plus, we'll share a special conversation with radio host Bob Reitman in honor of our 60th birthday.
Really listening to what community members need and want from us as a library has sort of really changed my whole viewpoint on my team's role, the library's role in the community.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Wisconsin's gun deer hunting season is in full swing. Several hundred thousand hunters wearing blaze orange or fluorescent pink are expected to participate in the 9-day season throughout the state. Many of those hunters use lead ammunition. Some advocates want the Department of Natural Resources to better warn people about the dangers of lead bullets contaminating harvested venison. Specifically, they think that people who eat donated deer meat should be warned about the risks. In recent months, these advocates took their concerns to the Wisconsin Natural Resources Board, which oversees the DNR. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz spoke to two of the people sounding the alarm about the risks of lead poisoning in venison. Susan Davidson is a physician who specializes in high-risk obstetrics. Retired veterinarian David Clausen served on the National Resources Board and is an avid hunter.
I started deer hunting in 1958 as a 12-year-old, and I have not missed a season ever since. My wife and I consume at least 3 deer a year, and it is our main red meat. In 2008, a doctor out in North Dakota who was a hunter tested some venison and found lead in it. And when I heard that, I took 20 packages of loins and steaks and roasts. They were no ground meat. It was all whole meat. And I x-rayed 20 packages in my office and was really surprised to find significant lead in 3 of those packages. And when I saw that, I have children and grandchildren, and there is no way I wanted them to consume that. So I got rid of my lead ammunition and switched to copper. And I now have on my farm and my woodland, I probably have 20 people that hunt that. Nobody hunts on my land with lead ammunition.
So Susan, if you would talk a bit about the impacts that lead exposure can have on everyone, but especially young children and pregnant women.
Lead is a potent neurotoxin. It's toxic to children and adults, but young children are the most vulnerable to it. It causes impaired brain development, is associated with poorer learning, hyperactivity, lower academic scores. We all store lead in our bones, and pregnant women mobilize it during pregnancy from their bones, and it gets into the fetus. And we know that a big activity of the fetus is growing nerve cells and growing nerve connections. So lead exposure at any time during reproductive life could potentially affect fetus. It's known, it's not only potential, it can affect fetuses, and the children can be born at a disadvantage. So my concern, I've spent my career taking care of pregnant women and hoping to deliver the best babies that will have the best future that can help us navigate this complex world. So my interest in lead as a toxin really is part of what has motivated me my whole life.
Talk about Wisconsin's donated deer program, how large that program is and what the dangers might be.
The deer donation program is a wonderful opportunity to get protein into the diets of people that really need it. The problem is the use of lead ammunition has led to contamination of some of that food. And a study by the DNR and DHS back in 2008 discovered that 15%, or one out of six packages that was commercially processed, was contaminated with lead at an average amount of 15,900 parts per billion. The Hunter processed venison was slightly less. I think there was 8% of that, but it was contaminated at 21,000 parts per billion. And the other issue is that DNR, and not just in Wisconsin, in several other states, has put this statement in saying that there are no studies demonstrating that eating lead in venison has caused any illnesses. Well, the reason there are no studies is that it's really kind of difficult to find study volunteers that will voluntarily eat a known amount of lead just to see how sick they get. The studies aren't done, but they can't be done. And so I will just say, if you look on the Wisconsin Eating Wild Game Safely, they deal with PFAS up in the Marinette area. And they say, don't eat the livers out of deer from this area because they contain PFAS and it's going to be harmful to your health. I'm kind of certain that there are not specific studies demonstrating that eating PFAS deer is going to make you sick. So why do we have a different view of the PFAS than we do of lead? Lead is a toxin. That's the bottom line.
So how did that study come to life, and what came out of it?
This happened in 2008 when I was on the Natural Resources Board, and I was quite interested in it. The DNR and DHS did a study on this after they saw that North Dakota thing, and basically surveyed a bunch of Wisconsin venison that was commercially processed and hunter processed. And this is the results they came up with. And they actually had a consultation with what's called ATSDR, which is the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. It's a federal agency. And when that first came out, Department of Health actually issued a letter to food pantries telling them not to distribute any venison unless they had it x-rayed by the local veterinarian or whatever. DNR got really active about it and was really doing good work on it. And then that just kind of went away. And I was surprised to look at the DNR's website and see that language in there about there are no studies. And I thought, this is not right. And so that's what got me involved here. If a hunter wants to go out and use lead ammunition and risk poisoning his family, that's probably his business. But here we're talking about people that need this are not being informed that one out of six packages is likely toxic. I think it is just not right that these people are being fed what they think is healthful meat when it's actually toxic. I think we have a duty to inform the consumers of this meat that it is toxic, and then let them make up their own mind. Minnesota x-rays every package of donated venison. I think it costs them like $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000 a year to do this, but it's a little different in Minnesota. Their Department of Agriculture has some say over what goes into people's diets. In Wisconsin, because venison is a donated meat, there is nobody looking over that. Not DADCAP, not DHS, not anybody else. It's just because it's donated meat, it's not regulated.
In Iowa, the donated venison is marked with a warning that says lead fragments may be found in processed venison. Children under 6 years old and pregnant women are at the greatest risk from lead. So that is one option, is just to actually just put a label on the food. The DNR does distribute posters and things to put around food banks, but this is not required. There's no enforcement involved. So actually, I mean, the very first step would be informing consumers of the food bank venison about the lead.
So David, fast forward, I guess this would be to this past August, and you spoke before the Natural Resources Board. What was the heart of your message?
Basically, the heart of my message was that I wanted DNR to remove that misleading statement that says there are no illnesses shown from people eating lead in venison. Again, those tests haven't been done. And what I objected to on that is that we're putting out a product, certain amounts of it are toxic. And by saying there's no health effects from this that have been demonstrated, it reassures the people that this is a healthy, good-tasting product, when in reality, the lead in that good-tasting venison is every bit as toxic as lead coming from anywhere else. And I just felt that it was not right to be trying to reassure people when what we were feeding them was not as healthy as it should be or could be.
Did you hear anything from the DNR or from the board after that?
Actually, I've talked to a couple of members of the board, and they are very concerned about this issue, and they would like to see it. I'm speaking for them, I guess. They have expressed to me that they would like to see this issue solved. I heard nothing from the department.
They are clearly considering this, but, you know, being concerned and taking action are two different things.
Could you outline what you think would be achievable and should be achieved goals in moving toward better informing and protecting the public?
I think we owe it to the public to be more transparent about the risks involved. So I would say better informing the public on the website. I would say better informing deer hunters, because I think they really have very little knowledge of this. So I think some sort of active education, such as when you get your license, receiving a piece of paper. I mean, that doesn't guarantee that somebody will read it, but at least they've been given this information.
I think one thing, back when I was on the board, the DNR did a great job of holding demonstrations for the use of non-lead ammunition. And they actually held them all over the state. I talked to a young man, they're avid deer hunters, and I was trying to talk to him about non-toxic ammunition. He looked at me, he says, "Oh, Doc," he said, "we switched to that long time ago because it kills so much better." He said, "We shoot it with the non-toxic bullet and the deer drops on the spot." He said, "We're not chasing it off someplace and having it get into a place where we don't have access to retrieve it and that type of thing. It's just so much more efficient than the lead." And I could say that too. People complain about, "Oh, it costs so much more money." I would say since I switched, my one-shot kills have greatly increased. If it costs more, but I'm only using one bullet instead of two or three, it's actually cheaper. So that's just my 2 cents worth.
I am not a hunter, but I do know that we've banned lead bullets in the hunting of waterfowl. So why can't we ban lead bullets in the hunting of deer?
That is not going to be immediate type of thing. That will take some work and some time.
I would even go further than Dave. It is not our private decision to poison our children. Families should really avoid giving lead-contaminated deer meat to their children. Everybody wants to have the healthiest children that they can. So I think that would be my final comment.
Susan Davidson is a physician at Dean SSM Health in Madison. She serves on the Wisconsin Birth Defect Surveillance Committee and is a member of the Wisconsin Environmental Health Network. David Clausen is a retired veterinarian from Amory, Wisconsin, and a former member of the Natural Resources Board. They spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Wisconsin's 9-day gun deer season runs through December 1st. In about 15 minutes, we'll spend some time with Bob Reitman, who you might know from his past show, It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music. He'll share stories from his career here at WUWM that started in the 1960s. But first, the next installment in our Books and Beyond series explores the new Entrepreneur in Residence program at Central Library. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thank you. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The library is more than just books. In our series with the Milwaukee Public Library, Books and Beyond showcases that by sharing resources, book recommendations, and some cool stuff you might not know about. Today, we're learning about MPL's Entrepreneur in Residence program. This initiative was launched in the summer of 2024 as a collaboration between the library and a local entrepreneur. The Entrepreneur in Residence program provides free workshops, one-on-one consultations, mentoring, and more to current and aspiring entrepreneurs and small business owners. The larger goal of the program is to help build an ecosystem that develops, sustains, and grows future entrepreneurs here in Milwaukee. To learn more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Christina Gomez, the Library Services Manager for the Business and Technology Department at Central Library, and Ellie Rivera, who was the first resident of the program.
So you shared some of the details of this program, but can you get into more of the specifics of what's required of the EIR during this time and what the relationship is like between the library and the resident?
Yeah, definitely. So the entrepreneur in residence, what we're asking of them is to not only bring in their experience with starting a small business, but also their passion for supporting the next generation of small business owners and entrepreneurs. So we ask that they spend time developing programs that will be hosted at the library, spending time mentoring the folks who are attending those workshops and looking for additional support for their business, and then collaborating with the library on building up our collection, right? So what books and resources are we offering as a library that can support this particular demographic? And then working with us to better enhance the services that we offer as a library as a whole.
Excellent. So Ellie, you're the first and latest EIR for the library. So can you share a bit about your background and what motivated you to apply?
Yeah, so I was most interested once the opportunity was presented, really being a lifelong serial entrepreneur, born and raised here in Milwaukee. The library, as I shared with Christina when we had first met, had some very personal connections, for me. And so really, it was just a perfect opportunity to tie in my life experience, my professional experience, and the wonderful network of folks that I have been fortunate to meet over my lifetime. And so it was a really natural fit. I was really excited when actually our venture capital fund manager had shared the information with all of us. And I thought, my goodness, this is an opportunity to have a real impact within the entrepreneur community, especially the more overlooked community at large that we saw as possibly being the main beneficiaries of the program.
Would you mind sharing a bit about your personal connection to the library, being a Milwaukee resident here?
Yeah. So definitely a very personal experience in that early on in my childhood, I had, due to mental health issues, a father who was absent from my life would occasionally pop in and out. And I knew that was always his sanctuary when he was kind of having his episodes. You know, we would often, not often, but in those frequent meetups, have the opportunity to connect, and it would oftentimes be there or in the neighborhood. And so that was always just kind of like an orbit that was familiar to me.
A safe space.
A safe space,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And then that's the case for a lot of people, definitely. And you mentioned that you're a serial entrepreneur. Can you explain some of the specifics or at least what you're currently doing as an entrepreneur in business?
Yeah, absolutely. My journey in entrepreneurship, I hadn't recalled this, but my mom often, reminds me of the times I would, sell my toys on the porch stoops to the neighborhood kids once I was tired of them. So it kind of began there and, had two roads, really. There was the kind of positive above ground entrepreneurship opportunities, and there were opportunities that led to some trouble in my life, which also is part of the story why I was so drawn to this opportunity.
And your work's mission revolves around the importance of justice-impacted entrepreneurship. So can you explain that concept a little bit more? And, what kind of businesses are showing this by example, whether it's your own or others you've supported?
Yeah, so the idea behind The Way Out and the online platform thewayouthelps.com is really originally focused 100% on working with justice-impacted individuals either in the community or coming out of incarceration, reentering, and matching them with supportive service providing organizations prior to the job board component, which is obviously finding employment from these fair chance employers. And so to answer the question, you know, of who are those employers, or at least what verticals, you know, they represent, a lot of our folks tend to gravitate and find success in hospitality, retail, construction, warehousing. Those are really, you know, some of the sweet spots. And of course, manufacturing here in Wisconsin is huge. And so, yeah, we're always looking for the business owners who lend themselves to giving folks second chances, sometimes third, fourth, fifth chances.
So to get into your residency a bit more, part of it involved creating workshops. There's one-on-one consultations to support aspiring and early stage entrepreneurs, and weekly office hours, just to mention a few things. So can you share with us any moments that stick out to you, you know, as you interacted with others in this role?
You know, I felt very fortunate to have followed up, kind of being on the receiving end of something similar to this, in that we were part of a Google Founders Fund that had a lot of these support mechanisms built in and workshops and stuff. So the content was really easy to kind of pick and choose what might be most beneficial. And so when it was you know, time to create the program, being able to tap into some of the prior workshops that I was able to participate in, I was really able to share out what we saw as the greatest foundational one. So, you know, of course, you know, building your brand, the social media market, the functionalities, the utilizing and leveraging different media outlets and such. I think some of the greatest responses were, we very intentionally had guest speakers at every one of these, was when we piped in a social media expert from the West Coast that helped with building your brand. Folks were really excited about that. Bringing in a few of the area entrepreneur organizations like Generator, BizStarts, and those have continued to support some of the entrepreneurs. So actually, you know, they're currently still benefiting from that relationship. And the coaching. I think that the coaching was where I've heard, you know, some of the greatest impact. Actually ran into somebody at the BizStarts fundraiser that was part of the program, and she was just ecstatic to see me, first of all, but then to say, hey, I'm actually in this program now. And so, you know, that has all been very satisfying.
Excellent, yeah. And this whole program, its aim is to build an ecosystem that develops and sustains and grows future entrepreneurs here in Milwaukee. But what do you feel are the community's strength and weaknesses when it comes to this goal to support entrepreneurs?
I think the intention is great. There's some really, really amazing stuff going on, and the intention of cultivating these spaces and offering these resources are really, you know, motivating and inspiring. I think where oftentimes opportunities are missed are really understanding the blind spots as they relate to the demographics that they're trying to serve, right? So sometimes, you know, seeing folks who don't represent the folks who are there to benefit can be challenging, because it's really important that we see others that look like us, talk like us, have come from our backgrounds, being the success stories we're trying to emulate. So I think that's it. But for the most part, the intention, the heart, you know, all of that is in the right place. And then the other part of entrepreneurship that I think is the greatest opportunity in our community is having potential customers, i.e. businesses, existing businesses, really support the entrepreneurs by purchasing their products and services, right? Rather than waiting until it's been refined or proven, part of, and certainly for us in the software space, part of it is growing through the bumps together with your first customers, right? And I think there's oftentimes a hesitation for established businesses to take that on. And I think if they just understood what a benefit having real life experience with real life customers can bring, maybe we would see more support directly and thereby creating some traction for these startups.
Do you think it's difficult? Because I feel like with entrepreneurship, it's such a individual thing of pride, right? To build something from the ground up, that sometimes it's hard to get over that hurdle and to create a more collaborative atmosphere?
That is part of it. You know, I think some of the experience both in the Entrepreneur in Residency program and certainly through the Google Latino Founders Fund, which we also participated with the Black Founders Fund, what you find, especially from those of us who've come from some of the more marginalized communities, the challenge really is feeling comfortable in the spaces with decision makers in some of these companies. And sometimes I think that comes off as unprepared or unready for that business to commit to purchasing from you or otherwise. And so those were the types of opportunities I was so blessed to address during this entrepreneurship and residency program, because it isn't just about programming and money. It is really helping people kind of get out of their own way so that they can succeed on a personal level, so then they can present on a professional level.
So this question is for the both of you with both your backgrounds and perspectives. So naturally, the people who participated, who were under you, Ellie, learned from this program. But what do you both feel you learned or, you know, had main takeaways from your experiences for this Entrepreneur in Residence?
As a librarian, you know, I often think about what my role is here in the community. As a business librarian especially, you know, I come into this space not having started my own business, but I'm very passionate about connecting people to resources, information. So I view myself as like a connector. And like learning from Ellie and learning from everyone, those 100 people who attended, is that really listening to what community members need and want from us as a library has sort of really changed my whole viewpoint on my team's role, the library's role in the community, and listening more intently and then delivering on what they're asking us to deliver on. So the feedback we received from Ellie's residency was like so, so positive. And they literally told us, like, we are looking for more financial planning, financial literacy workshops for business owners. That's something we can deliver as a library. So both that kind of like intentional listening and also just feeling really inspired by the passion that everyone brings to the project and to these spaces.
And for you?
I think the first takeaway was during our first session, which was understanding the tremendous amount of resources that are available for entrepreneurs in the library. You know, oftentimes as entrepreneurs or startup founders, you know, it's more about kind of finding what's your cool office going to look like or something like that.
Sure.
And then, you know, really realizing like, you can have an office, you can have resources, and at low to no cost, and it's called the library. It's kind of your incubator, right? So that was really eye-opening, you know, everything from the free databases that you could use to the meeting spaces to the, you know, individual conference rooms and such. So that was huge, just understanding that. And now having 6 children who are all entrepreneurs, having an opportunity to share with them, like, hey, go to the library.
Yeah.
So that was really cool. I think the gratitude from the community, as Christina was saying, you know, running into folks and them remembering and highlighting and continuing to be tapped in, that was really incredible. Again, the gratitude. I knew people would be grateful for the opportunity, but not at the level that they have been. So that's been awesome. And yeah, it's just all around was a wonderful experience.
Well, Christina and Ellie, thank you both so much for joining me today to share more about the Entrepreneur in Residence program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christina Gomez is the Library Services Manager for the Business and Technology Department at Central Library. Ellie Rivera is co-founder and CEO of The Way Out, and Milwaukee Public Library's first Entrepreneur in Residence. They both joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for our Books and Beyond series. Milwaukee Public Library is currently taking proposals through December 1st for their next Entrepreneur in Residence. You can find more information on how to apply at wuwm.com. A new season of Bubbler Talk is underway, but we still need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at wuwm.com. We'll take one more break, then return with a special conversation with local radio legend Bob Reitman. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM is celebrating 60 years on the air, and we're recognizing it in a variety of ways. One of those is an upcoming hour-long special, Rock and Roll Poet, a Reitman Retrospective. It honors legendary Milwaukee radio personality and our now retired co-worker Bob Reitman. Reitman actually started his radio career in 1966 at WUWM, and he finished it here in April of 2024. During the time in between, he was a formative figure in Milwaukee's counterculture scene and the city's early rock radio stations. He also co-hosted one of Milwaukee's top-rated morning shows, Reitman and Mueller, for 24 years. The upcoming special will dive into his radio career, how he was introduced to his favorite musician, Bob Dylan, and share the first poem he ever wrote. For today, we wanted to give you a preview of the special, starting with a conversation between Reitman and WUWM's Lori Jones.
All right, so first of all, I want to thank you for joining me today to celebrate the 60th birthday of WUWM. And then, of course, we're going to talk about your almost 60 years on Milwaukee airwaves. But I want to start at the beginning. Did you grow up in Milwaukee?
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Born in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
My dad was an FBI agent. They'd moved him around. But I was here by the time I was pretty young, 5, 6, something like that.
Okay. Yep. So this is home for you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you, I know you've got a brother, but do you have other siblings?
I do. My brother's name is Bill,
mm-hmm.
and my sister's name is Joellen,
mm-hmm.
and they're still around. I'm the old one in the family. We had great parents and no complaints growing up in Whitefish Bay. It was Ozzie and Harriet all the way. It was idyllic.
Yeah. So what did you want to be as a kid when you were growing up?
I really didn't know, but I did realize one thing when I was about probably 11 or so. You know, you go to school and then you got all summer
mm-hmm.
to play. And I thought, you know, I got to find a job that's just like having summer vacation. And that's, I found it.
And what was that?
Radio. I didn't.
At 11?
No.
Oh.
Just I needed a job.
Okay.
That would give me that joy.
Okay.
You know, if you're not, I mean, I never really worked.
Mm-hmm.
Worked at. I just had fun.
Right.
Yep.
Right. So you must have listened to the radio then a lot growing up as a kid or not.
Yeah. I mean, back then, there was no top 40 radio. Mm-hmm. I heard the Weavers, which was interesting. Good Night, Irene. I remember us jumping around to that or listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then the top 40 came in. That was our only choice. And
mm-hmm.
some of the guys who were on the radio had to transition from, I don't know, easy listening music to rock and roll. And they did okay, you
right.
know. And there were some good guys on the radio, too. Charlie Hanson and
mm-hmm.
Shaky. I thought they were two different people. That's how good he was. And Rocky Fox, Pat Shanahan, who was really great. He just passed away. And he was my program director at one of the stations.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very interesting guy. And I don't know, other guys on the radio like Bad Mad Michaels and Seamus O'Hara and all those, that's who we listened to back then.
Right. And those sort of were your inspirations.
Well, I liked the music. When they were DJing, they did a good job. Some of them were funny. Some were clever. They just entertained us.
Right, right. So you went to Marquette. You got a degree in English. Mm. Were your plans afterwards to work in radio?
No. I was managing a cemetery. Very responsible job. I had over 40,000 people under me. Thank you. But my godfather owned a cemetery, and I worked out there when I was in the summers when I was in high school, made enough money to pay the tuition at Marquette, by the way, which was $325 a semester.
Wow.
I know, because it's ridiculous now.
Right.
But that was how much it was then, so I could earn the money for college and worked in the cemetery, and it was a job. But then all sorts of things started happening in the mid-60s. Follow that dream, you know.
Well, okay, so that was a great transition for me. Thank you, because I wanted to talk to you about Kaleidoscope.
Okay.
Which was and correct me if I'm wrong, but it was like an underground newspaper, right, that you helped found in 67 or so, and it ran to about 71.
Okay.
What type of topics did you cover, and what was its purpose?
Well, my best friend, John Coyce, was the editor, and he'd been out to the West Coast right at the right time, and he saw things happening, like the news, underground newspapers and the radio and stuff like that. And he, basically, the way I saw Kaleidoscope is when we started, John Solly, who is a good friend of mine, and Coyce and I were involved. I was a poetry editor. John Solly was basically the graphics editor. I mean, if you look at those old Kaleidoscopes, great graphics. And Coyce was the editor, but I think the philosophy was, well, whoever comes through the door and has an agenda, we'll put them on. And it went from a pretty much of a idyllic kind of flower child kind of thing into pretty radical politics over that span of time, because the people doing the radical, whatever you want to call it, politics, they were the ones that were pumped up to do something, and they got a voice in the paper. It was a great run, you know.
What did you enjoy most about working on the Kaleidoscope?
Being the poetry editor, all I had to do was look at poetry and say, decide, well, this should go in or this shouldn't. And then this guy named Jim Sorcett came along, and I read his poetry, and I thought, what am I? This guy should do it. And so I abdicated, and he became the poetry editor, really a good poet. And at that point, Coyce and I were and still our best friends. He decided to go. We were doing radio here at this station, and he decided to devote time to the paper. And I said, oh, I get to do the radio. You know, and just worked out well.
So, again, a great transition. Thank you for setting me up, Reitman, for this. So the station is celebrating 60 years.
Yep.
It signed on in 1964, September of 1964. You hit the airwaves in 1966, according to research that I've done here at WUWM. How did you end up at UWM-Milwaukee, the university? Were you there as a student?
No.
Oh.
Eventually, I was a student. But at that point, we were asking Dr. Ruane Hill. I was doing a poetry show at WUWM called Sense Wave.
Right.
And Coyce and I decided to ask Dr. Hill, could we have an hour, a couple hours on Sunday nights? And you know what he said? Yeah, just like that. It was amazing. And years later, not that long ago, he just passed away.
Yep.
He was 99.
Yep.
And I don't know if I ever met a sharper person at any age. It was like, we'd have an hour conversation and 98%, I just listened to him.
Yeah.
But we came in here and asked him if we could do the show. And he right away said yes. And when I talked to him the last time we met, I asked him, how come he said yes so quickly? And he said, well, my kids were always on my case to play, have rock and roll on the station. So he followed what they told him to do, which is pretty neat.
Smart man, right?
Yep.
So before we started, we were talking a little bit about what WUWM was like in those early days. It was in the basement of a building at the university. What else do you remember about those early days?
Well, in the early days, there was an engineer behind the glass. He put up the records. We just told him what to play. And I remember one guy, I mean, they were our records, you know?
Yeah.
And here he is picking up my record. He was eating fried chicken, and he smeared it all over the record. I think he's a doctor now somewhere, but He did all that work. And when they told us that we had to do the running the board and everything, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that was, that might have been the next step where we went out to a ZMF. But this guy, whoever it was, the engineer, he'd run everything. And we just sit back and relax. It was like listening to another radio station or something. But that ended.
That ended? Why did that end?
Well, the first job we got was at ZMF because mm-hmm. WUWM got ratings. And the reason wasn't that we were that incredibly good. It was that there was a huge audience to hear the Grateful Dead, Dylan, the Stones, mm-hmm. Pink Floyd, all that stuff. Nobody was playing it. And this audience, the people that listened to that, they loved it.
They were hungry for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were we. And so it was a privilege to play that music for them. And when I went, and we got ratings. So all of a sudden, this small little station comes up and they asked to meet with us. Mm-hmm. And they asked me if I wanted to do a show 5 or 6 nights a week for $150. I would have done it for 50. I was so happy that they asked me to do that. And that's when I had to run my own board. And I thought, this is it. I won't be able to do this, which is ridiculous. It wasn't that. It was fun.
Right, right. Yes, it is fun. I agree with you. I'm going to take just a moment to reintroduce you. If you're just joining us, I'm WUWM's Lori Jones, speaking with Bob Reitman, the retired host of It's All Right, Ma, It's Only Music. He's here to share his memories of working at the station in honor of our 60th birthday. So, Reitman, after you left WUWM, you went on to have a successful career, whether you believe it or not, in rock radio and then at WKTI. But I want to talk about when you came back to WUWM in January of 2007. How did that happen? How did that all come together?
Honest to God, it's a great story. I had retired at 65 from KTI, and I thought to myself, maybe I'll go down to UWM and ask them if I can do a show. I'll wait, a few months. And we got a call. I got a call from Bruce Winter and Dave Edwards. Mm-hmm. And I came in here and they sat me down and they said, would you like to do an hour a week? Or something like that. And I said, yeah, I'd do that. Whatever you want. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And that happened. It was fortuitous. And Bruce Winter dearly loved him. Mm-hmm. We were really close. And Dave Edwards, he was a perfect general manager. My experience at this station, and I'm not saying this because we're on that radio station now, but it was sort of the way I thought radio should be. Lots of times, I think over the years, I had one station where I had a top 40 DJ become our program director. And when he let me go, he said, it's with great pleasure I hand you your license. We used to have a license.
I remember I had one.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yep, we just have a license. And different ZMF and all the ones that followed were always an adventure. Mm-hmm. And I think the secret to it was hiring people who loved music. And when I was a program director, which is weird, but I only hired people who loved music. And Ron Kuzner, who was my boss here, the program director, I got to be his boss, which meant I didn't bother him at all. And he was, to this day, people talk about how good he was. Mm-hmm. But that was at TOS. Mm-hmm. And so hiring music freaks was what I did. And, you have to have some kind of a feeling about talking into a microphone, and they did, and everybody did a pretty good job. It didn't last real long, but it was fun.
Yeah. So when Bruce and Dave reached out to you to ask you to come back to the station, I mean, were there any non-negotiables for you, or did you just jump at it right away, or did you say, I'll come if I can do X, Y, Z?
No, there was no if.
Okay.
I mean, I asked him some questions. Mm-hmm. I said, what if I want to play 3 songs in a row? Well, you can do that. What if it's 5 songs? You can do that. Everything I asked, I said, you could do that. It was like a free ride. It was a disc jockey's dream, really. Yeah, right. And sometimes we'd play, because my son was with mm-hmm. me for a number of years, Bobby, and we did shows, and sometimes we'd do 25, 30 minutes of music. So what? I remember one guy called out. He had to drive for about an hour that night that we were on the air, and he loved it because just crank the radio, and we didn't say, I didn't talk as much.
Right.
And then that wasn't the point. We weren't there to talk. We were there to play music.
Gotcha.
And it was fun.
And no commercials.
No commercials. Yeah.
So you mentioned Bobby. He was a co-host with you right. for many years on It's All Right, Ma, when you came back yep. to WUWM for the second time. And then in these past few years, your grandson, Bert, would also sit in on occasion. So what did it mean for you to have them join you?
Well, interesting thing is we all had the same first.
Yeah, I know. You're Robert Jr. and Bobby's Robert the Third, right?
And the second.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You're second. Yeah. Now you're the second.
My mom would not let them put a junior.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you're always the second.
Yep. And Bobby was a third.
Yep.
And Bert is short for Robert.
Right.
So we don't get too confused. And he's the fourth.
Yep.
And he's 10 years old. It was tricky putting him on the air, but he just took to it. And I'm sure some people liked it and some people didn't, but I liked it.
I loved it.
Good. Thank you.
He was fun to listen to.
He was. It was spontaneous. No fear of being on the air.
Right.
Which is unusual since I was terrified every time I started. But Bobby did a good job, too.
Yeah. Were you the one who picked most? No, well, no. He got to pick a song every once in a while, right? Bobby did.
Bobby, yeah. He got a little segment that he did. And basically, what he chose to do was either play stuff that he really liked or that was new.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I was the guy who played a lot of older stuff. But I played new stuff, too. So it was fun.
Yeah. What was the last It's All Right, Ma show like?
Well, I really worked on that one because I wanted that to be a really good show. A really, really good show. And I spent some time on it. A lot of times it was just spontaneous in there. But this one I worked on and I got the message across that I wanted to get across, and I would say it was 95% what I wanted.
What was that message?
It was just a mix of music that made some sense. Putting a show like we did together is, it's like putting words into a poem. Each song was like a word in a poem. There was always a theme of one sort or another. It could be about rivers, or it could be about broken hearts. There's never a lack of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to do a show at the end that just sort of was something that I wanted to say through music.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Are poetry and music different extensions of the same form of expression for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I loved writing poetry. I mean, it's a very personal thing. I used to read poems at the Avant-Garde.
Mm-hmm.
And the first couple of weeks, I was all excited. I'm going to read my stuff and see if people like it. Went down there, and the guy that ran the poetry readings wasn't there. It was a big disappointment. And then the next week, it was a Monday night or whatever, I went down the next Monday night, he wasn't there again. So I asked Harold Strohmeyer, who owned the Avant-Garde at that point, I said, I'd be happy to run the poetry readings. He said, oh. Yeah. I said, can I do that? And he said, yes. Just like Ruane Hill said, yes. I mean that. I'm so lucky that these guys said yes. And so I ran the poetry readings, but I formatted it slightly. It's Chicago poets, women poets, UWM poets, Marquette poets, open mic. You know, it was really fun to do that. And this guy came up to me. I was standing in front of the Avant-Garde one warm summer night, and he came up and he said, would you like to do Sense Waves? Well, that was being done by the same guy that wasn't showing up running the poetry readings, and he was moving out of the city.
Yeah.
So I said, radio, why don't you do it? And he said, no, I can't do it. He was just a bit insecure. He said, I can't do that. And I said, well, yeah, I'll do it because it's a way to get more poetry out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that for a while, and then that's when we ran into Dr. Hill and said, well, I'm here now. Can we just have three or four more hours? I should have put that in at the question you asked before. But he said, yes. So we did poetry, and then we did the music show. And I think I dropped the poetry and just did the music show. And got ratings and
the rest is history, yeah, as they say.
I know how lucky I am. I mean, I'm not being anything but honest here. I know how lucky I was. I mean, guys like Dr. Hill and Harold, they said yes. And so the door was open.
That was WUWM's Lori Jones with Bob Reitman for a preview of the upcoming special Rock and Roll Poet, a Reitman retrospective. The full hour-long special will first air on November 28th at noon. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about the local and national legacy of Vel Phillips. Plus, we'll have the latest live at Lake Effect, featuring Blitzen Trapper. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.